This is the second day on which we're concentrating on his ambiguity, his poems that have more than usual ambiguity, a somewhat arbitrary classification, if the truth be told, because all poems have an element of ambiguity about them, I suppose, especially if you stretch the word ambiguity as far as I stretch it. For example, I'm using it to include metaphor in the sense that maybe the obvious meaning is not totally in sync with a comparison that may be being made at levels below the most obvious level. Maybe there's an element of contradiction, maybe there's an element of sarcasm, an element of kidding, fooling. "You've got to watch my fooling," Robert Frost used to say. "You've got to watch me or I'll fool you." That was one of the things that he would occasionally say to people. We have talked previously about some of his humorous poems, a series of poems which had more than usual ability to tickle our funny bones. We've talked about some of his views on poetry and how they are reflected in some of his poems. And we've talked about some of his nature poems. And after we finish with some of these poems that I have really quite arbitrarily classified as ambiguous poems, I will be talking for the next couple of days about some of his poems related to Stoicism, some of them that have a New England quality of the Stoic. Grin and bear it. Take life as it is. Those are fun, and some of them are quite provocative. Yes, indeed.
Was he a favorite of John F. Kennedy?
He was indeed a favorite of John F. Kennedy.
And wasn't he one of the speakers?
He was indeed.
He wrote a poem for it.
He wrote a poem for it, which is in the book which I'm using. It turned out to be a kind of addition to a previous poem which he had written called The Gift Outright. The additional lines that he wrote, he called for John F. Kennedy on his inauguration. And Kennedy did do him the honor of asking him to come and be present and to say a few words at his inauguration in 1960. It was the first time that any American president had done that, and Frost was very honored.
As you speak, I can think of it before. I had lit some of this up. A little fire arose under the podium. And this was a kind of a lot of snow in Washington, D.C.
There was. It was a very snowy day.
You had to put that fire out.
Yes, and
they heated the floors, or just what?
Yeah, and even more germane to Frost's appearance was, you recall that there was a lot of glare from the outdoor sun, and it was rather windy as well, so Frost was unable to read the poem. They tended to move, but it was mostly the glare. And as I recall, it was President Eisenhower who got up and put his hat over, trying to protect the light in order that Frost could read, a very gracious gesture. I'm quite sure it was Eisenhower. Do you remember who it was? You were there. I was watching it on television.
All of this just occurred to me now, where I'd have done a little research before I came here.
Yeah. Well, I remember it too, but it's hard to remember precisely. I remember somebody, it could have been Chief Justice Warren, possibly. It was either he or Ike, I think. And it still didn't work. So Frost instead just simply recited The Gift Outright, a poem that he knew by heart. No, they weren't going right, but it was a kind of a discombobulated session. It was a discombobulated day because of the terrific snowstorm. Lots of people had to walk. People got cold. People didn't show up. Yeah, but it was a festive day nevertheless. I'd like to suggest that we start. I do have a couple of copies, by the way, of our text. Our text is a rather loose phrase. This is an anthology put together by Louis Untermeyer, who was a very good editor and a close friend of Frost's, quite a close friend. And I have two earlier editions of this same poem, which has been offered for sale in our bookstore. I'm sorry to say that it's sold out. I guess I'm sorry to say that. I guess I'm glad it's had that kind of response too. But may I pass this to somebody? Perhaps you'd like to have a look and maybe pass it along. If not, maybe you want to take a look too and pass it on too. I'll hang on to this one and read from this one. The one that I want to read first is one of his best known. Indeed, I want to start off with two of his very best known poems, starting off with The Road Not Taken on page 223. Page 223. This is possibly his best known poem of all, although that's hard to say. The Road Not Taken. I'll read this one, and then I will be asking some of you to read some of them if you would like to share this pleasure with me. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry that I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though, as for that, the passing here had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves, no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. What do you think he's saying here? Did you sense some qualities about this poem that prompted me to want to share this with you and our discussion about ambiguity?
A lot of roads in life, like who we marry, and determines which direction our life goes. Never know how our life would have gone if we had married someone else, not married another person.
Yes, indeed. You think of that too, huh? I thought I was maybe the only one who thought that. What else? Yeah, that's certainly part of it. Yeah, but it's really not that much less traveled, is it? He kind of fudges that. I mean, he says, though as for the passing there, it had worn them really about the same. So he really didn't make a very considered choice. It was somewhat arbitrary on his part to make that choice. What is his attitude, do you think, toward the person that he's referring to here? That is to say, it's in the first person, but he's kind of commenting. Perhaps he's commenting. It seems to me perhaps he's commenting on the fellow who's talking here. Maybe that's because I'm a melancholy, understated kind of guy. Maybe. Maybe not. I wasn't necessarily trying to slant it any one way. I was just trying to feel it as I read it. What do you think his attitude is? Does he respect this person's contemplative attitude toward this decision? Does he think this is kind of a natural?
I thought Spotty was respecting the fact that he chose the one that wasn't the most common and the most trodden down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds to me like respect should try something.
Okay, then what about his subsequent actions or attitudes, which prompts him to think back on that decision years and years later and said, boy, that made all the difference, and to consider that, to toss that idea around.
Whether that was a good or a bad.
Yeah, whether it's a useful thing or whether it's a commendable.
I've
He one time asked a question that I'm going to ask you about the poem. When he was discussing the poem, he said, "What about that sigh?" We just read to the last verse. "I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference." Now, he never would say anything more than that, by the way. He never would say anything more than that.
Mm-hmm. But you wrote something that I never thought of. Because I've always, when I've read this, read it, it was done the way you did it. Melancholy way, non-committal. But what if you read it with excitement or romance, sigh with...
What would happen if you read that poem with excitement now?
That's what I'm saying. I mean,
I'll read just the end again, because I think the other part of it is fairly obvious, but let me read the other with what I suggest may be what he meant by, "What about that sigh?" That's a provocative question. He didn't usually do that, all right? All right, let me just try this. "I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference." Sir?
Well, you're talking about a basic division among poets. Some poets favor what's called performance reading, you know, like an actor would read it and modifying the reading, and others favor kind of a low profile reading of it that is very effective, because it makes you concentrate on the words themselves,
yeah,
rather than and the thought.
What I was trying to do there as an actor was to concentrate on the sigh, because that's the word that he spoke. If you emphasize the sigh, what does it do to the reading, was what was in my mind as I tried to act it out a little more. Yes?
It seems to me that he's saying that there are a lot of decisions that we make in our lives that appear to be as close to this call as that, and not until years later can we look back, and then we see and say with a sigh, that decision was the one that made all the difference.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that.
Yeah, we don't.
Not only that, I think that every choice you make means that every choice you make for something means that you also rule out other choices that might have been made. And that with that, there are sometimes regrets later about what you've been left out of.
This could sort of fit into his arrogance, too, that in some way he made the correct decision where many people wouldn't have or
this person, because I think the sigh may be commenting on it. What about a sigh? Let's think about a sigh. What?
I don't think a sigh is always a sad sigh. I think a sigh can be a wonderment and a...
Would you give us a sigh, please? And then maybe get a little vocalization behind it also. Give us a little vocalization with just that, please. Regret?
Oh, I should have. I knew I should have written that letter.
Okay, now what does that suggest to you? What do you feel?
Take a long bath.
Regrets?
My auntie is 95 now, and she's doing a lot of sighing and saying it's a fool that I had. Definitely not.
Yeah.
Size of completion that you finally have reached a goal, like at last, you know.
But in this sense, it's not, it seems to be completion.
Well, I don't think so either, but there are different kinds of size.
Tommy. Is that a sigh? Is that a sigh like this? Oh, if only I'd taken that other path.
But you know, Tom, in reading it now, I think a key to me is, I kept the first for another day, knowing how way leads on to way. And how many times do we, when we have to make a decision, definitely decide, okay, I'm going to go this way today, but I'll be back next week and I'm going to go the other way. Or, you know, you have fully intend to do something when you have to make a choice, and you choose one way and you fully intend to do the other one. You know, you may even set the time when you're going to do it. And like he says, the way leads to way, and before we know it, you...
It's okay. It's right. And that's the way it is. And what's the sense of looking back and saying, oh, if only I had married John instead of Peter. Well, I wouldn't have little Harriet, nor little Gwendolyn, nor little Cecily. Oh, for Pete's sake, give me a break, will you?
It's kind of like looking at the ocean.
Yeah, it's a little like looking at the ocean. What are you doing just standing there looking out at the ocean? What are you doing looking back and wondering what it would have been like if you'd gone to North High School instead of South High School? You wouldn't have met your lifelong sweetheart there. You might have played basketball instead of hockey. You might have majored in X instead of Y. Come on, that's not a very useful activity, is it, really? But then we can have an attitude toward what they're doing. Yeah. 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 I don't think he's being overly scornful, but I'm picking up now. I don't know what he meant here. It was just one of those poems where people ask him what he meant, and he said, if I wanted you to know, I would have told you in the poem. But the only thing I'm commenting on is the fact that rarely did he ever give you any other clues. He said, if I wanted you to know, I'd have put it in the poem. Or some people would say, did you mean this? And he said, no, I didn't mean that. But if you think I mean that, it's yours. No extra charge. But he did in this poem say, what about that sigh? And therefore, I think he may be giving us a clue. When I hear sigh, I think, well, gee, don't you have anything to do than sit there and sigh about what used to be or what might have been or if I'd only... If only I had. That's kind of not very useful activity. Sir?
So he may be a little bit ambivalent about it, too, there. It seems that made all the difference. There's something positive about that, though. You never know exactly where you might have ended up if you took the other way.
Yeah, yeah.
I think there's some satisfaction with the road he took, even though he may be curious about what would have happened the other way.
Yeah, it's the sigh that seems to run counter to that. I mean, yeah. Wasn't it Plato who said the unexamined life is not worth living?
No.
So the examined life is to go back there and say what I might have done would have changed things, and that therefore I'll do better in the future, for example. But the sigh is what I find kind of interesting, especially since he pointed it up. And a sigh is a special kind of an articulation. Well, I guess we haven't got the answer, have we? I'm sorry about that, right? I'm not here to give the answers. Anybody think I'm here to give you the answers to these poems? No, you may be excused if that's your thought. I mean, that's not going to happen. Let's take another really well-known one on page 94. Page 94, another one that he always read every time he gave a reading. This is Mending Wall on page 94. Mending Wall. Page 94.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends a frozen ground swell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The works of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair. When they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding. To please the yelping dogs, the gaps I made. No one has seen them made or heard them made. But at spring, mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line, and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves, and some are merely balls. We have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are till our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Just another kind of outdoor game. One on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is a mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I build a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone, grasping it firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, in the shade of trees. He will not go beyond his father's saying, and he lives, having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors.
Thank you. Mending Wall. Very New England poem. Because that's where you have those rocks that keep pushing up to the surface, and every spring you find them there. And you have to deal with them. And the way New Englanders dealt with them from the first times that they settled on those farms was to put them into walls and set out the territory, and sometimes to put a wall between your territory and your neighbor's territory. And then you had to keep the wall up because otherwise you'd just have a mess. But this is a little different process here. We've got two people who are putting the wall between them back up. What do you think about this poem? Any reflections on this? Why?
The thought came, I read this many times, but the thought came.
The other guy, you mean?
The person who's speaking.
The protagonist. Yeah. He's taking them out. What's he doing with them?
Huh.
That would be kind of an elaborate gag, wouldn't it? Yeah, there's enough force, which is one of the points of the poem, causing the rocks to fall away from the wall. And indeed, there's a good picture here of the wall, which those of you who have it, just pass it around, would you? Because you see what happens to the walls. It does happen that way. I've lived in New England enough to know that, indeed, the walls do just tend to fall down. So they're putting them back together is a neighborly act.
They do it together, which is interesting.
They do it together, and yet they have a different attitude toward the task, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
What does that tell us?
That there's already a dividing wall between them.
Yeah. Different way of looking at things. That's all almost inevitable, isn't it, among neighbors, between neighbors? What else do you think might be said for that difference? What is the difference between them? What do you think there's, how would you define the difference between them?
One seems to be looking backwards to his father's saying, and he can't get beyond that. The other has really analyzed the situation and says there's no reason for these walls. It's not like we have cattle that are getting into each other's property or a worry about the apple orchard and the pine grove.
Who's the younger of the two?
I would guess that the speaker is the younger, but
yeah.
Not necessarily. I think that's a stereotype. my own experience.
Maybe it's a stereotype.
He may be the older.
But it seems right to me somehow that we would be talking about a younger man who wants to analyze everything, obnoxious young whippersnapper that he is. Seems to me the old way is the best ways. Don't you think that? What my father told me and his father told him is the way it ought to be. God dang it. A young fella lives next door, doesn't think it's necessarily the way you got to do it. Well, got to have some standards, don't we? Got to keep that wall together between us. But Mr. Jones, there are no cows that are going to get over there. Good fences make good neighbors. Well, do good fences make good neighbors, do you think? Is that right?
Not always.
Not always, Gertrude. Why do you say, why do you qualify it that way? Yeah, sometimes they make resentment between neighbors, don't they? Yeah, the person puts a big high fence between his or her lot and yours.
Maybe before I came out, not dividing me, but to God, I suddenly feel like I'm in a crate.
Yeah. What's that neighbor have against you, do you think, Gertrude? What have you been doing?
But I, you know, I don't get to look through it anymore.
Yeah.
I don't like walls. I don't either.
So you think they don't necessarily make good neighbors, huh?
She's
you like that open prairie. Yeah, how about city folks? We got some city folks here? How
does? City folk, and I'm a native.
Sir?
Well, I travel around a lot of the city, and I in general, people like it to have a fence space because they don't have the dogs running across, they don't have the kids running across, they don't have to share their space. And, you know, they're more comfortable with it because human animals are territorial. You know, that's an instinct that you find in a lot of other species, too.
So perhaps, though, wouldn't you agree, perhaps what you're saying is that they are happier in their more isolated state without the neighbor's kids running across the yard, etc. But are they better neighbors as a result of that?
Well, it's urban living, you know, that's what it is.
If you define your property and the other property and you have something that defines it and you respect it, then that there is an element of tending to make good neighbors that way, whereas without it, one may tend to
there would be the definition tends to waylay the possibility of dispute.
Right.
Sir?
Is it that good conservative Yankee attitude of mind your own business? Or my neighbor and I mind our own business and our business?
I shouldn't wonder there's a bit of that in there, yes. Yes, yes. That's the way I always found it when I lived in New Hampshire. Yes, sir.
I remember the difference our kids felt. We live on the West Coast, although I am from the East Coast, and they're used to the beaches on the West Coast up in Washington, Oregon, where when you get on the beach, you can just walk and walk and walk because the beaches don't belong to anybody. They're not allowed to. We went to go back because they're where I was from, and we went out to the beaches, and the people that owned the land, there was a fence across the beach, and you didn't get to go down to the beach unless it was a public beach, and that was the driveways. And our kids were just utterly amazed at those fences.
Yes.
Kept them away from that beach. So there's the fence.
It's very Eastern, isn't it? It's very old world. If you go from the West to the East and then to Europe, continuing on East, you do have a sense of this kind of isolation, everybody setting off his or her own territory, separating himself or herself from the neighbors. That's right. And that, I suppose, it's an old way of looking at things. Whereas the younger person in the poem is maybe a more Western. Westerners are more youthful, right? We're all youthful out here in the West. Yeah, everybody out here is youthful, right? Ingrid.
But the protagonist is younger or older, is appealing to a higher being, that the neighbor says good fences make good neighbors, and that's hereditary, that's from my father and grandfather. The protagonist says something there is that doesn't love a wall, as though there's a power afoot in the universe that's greater than us, that knows about all.
Yeah, it certainly could be. It certainly could be that. For example, there is the law of gravity. At the very most simple elementary level, the law of gravity tends to make roundish boulders tumble off when the ice gets between, when the water gets between. There is just it may look secure this year, but for some reason that particular boulder falls over and rolls across a couple of yards away from the wall. And is that divine intervention? Perhaps something there is that wants it to be open, that doesn't like. Tradition reminds me of the song, right? And tradition in Fiddler on the Roof. And who's for the tradition? Tevye. And who's against the tradition? His kids. Kids, yes.
Well, they gotta get the boulders out of
the same phenomenon as in New England. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so it has a practical application. But the query is that the young fellow is asking his older neighbor, if we buy the assumption that he's a younger person, a kid, if you please, just a youngster, he's questioning whether there is any intrinsic merit in doing so. Just
an outsider, though, someone coming in there.
Oh, heaven forfend! He might be, though. That would be something, wouldn't it? I think they're rebuilding a fence that has been there traditionally.
Well, that's true.
I think the young fellow's actually being pretty good-natured. I think he's just kidding his older neighbor friend, don't you think? He's sure. Not being mean. He's just pressing him a little bit. If the neighbor said, well, I don't know why we're doing this, but it's probably a good idea, keep things tidy around the place, right? The kid would probably say, hey, yeah, that's probably right. I'll go along with that. But when he puts an higher purpose on it, you see, and says, good fences make good neighbors, that provokes the kid, the younger person, to say, well, now let's analyze that for a moment. I learned over at Dartmouth College across the way here that we got to analyze these things. Why do they make good neighbors? And the fellow's not going to give him a very thoughtful response.
One of the things I noticed when I looked at it is that what the protagonist says about the other guy is that he won't go behind his father's thing, not beyond it, but behind it, which means that this guy isn't even willing to look at the reason that his father said that. If there's a good reason, you know, maybe there is a good reason, but he never examined his father's reason.
Right.
He won't go behind it. And so that seems to me that this man is stuck in tradition, and that's why the young man is, or the...
At least the young man perceives him as being stuck. You know, the young man would question every tradition. That's what they taught him up at Dartmouth College down the street here. You know, question everything. Drive you crazy, these young fellows. Let's take a look at another interesting form, page 189. Gertrude, do you want to read this one for me?
Gertrude usually is good about reading form.
Yeah,
you are. This is short.
For once, then, something.
Others taught me with having knelt at well curves, always wrong to the light, so never seeing deeper down in the well than where the water gives me back in a shining surface picture, me myself, in the summer heaven, godlike, looking out of a wreath of fern and cloud puffs, so long since. Once, when trying with chin against a well curve, I discerned, as I thought, beyond the picture, through the picture, something white, uncertain, something more of the depths, and then I lost it. Water came to rebuke the too clear water. Water came to rebuke the too clear water. One drop fell from a fern, and lo, a ripple shook wherever it was, lay there at the bottom, blurred it, and blotted it out. What was that whiteness? Truth? A pebble of quartz? For once,
then. Let me give you another crack at it. That was nice, Richard. I'll just read it again because it's nicely intricate. Aha, it's a little ambiguous, right? For once, then, something. I'll give this a little New England twang to give it a little difference and see how you like that. Others taunt me with having knelt at well curbs, always wrong to the light, so never seeing deeper down in the well than where the water gives me back in a shining surface picture, me, myself, in the summer heaven, godlike. Looking out of a wreath of fern and cloud puffs. Once, when trying with chin against a well curb, I discerned, as I thought, beyond the picture, through the picture, a something, white, uncertain, something more of the depths. And then I lost it. Something more of the depths, pardon me. Water came to rebuke the too clear water. One drop fell from a fern, and lo, a ripple shook whatever it was lay there at the bottom, blurred it, blotted it out. What was that whiteness? Truth? A pebble of quartz? For once, then, something. What was it? You've looked, is everybody looked down a well at one point or another? You look down at the well, and what do you see? Well, hello. What a good-looking fellow I am. Gosh, I didn't realize I looked so well against this nice blue light with the clouds up there. Yes, indeed. I think Narcissus had something. That's what you see. And if you try to see something else, it's hard. But this particular person did indeed see something down there, so he or she thought. What did he or she see, do you think?
It may have been truth. It may have been a piece of quartz.
Yeah? Yeah.
His imagination.
Yeah. His imagination might.
It was something.
It was? You think it was something?
I do.
You do? What do you think it was?
The ripple.
Yeah, as has happened to him before, when he couldn't see anything beyond, right? So if you had to say what you think it is, what do you think it was?
It could have been light and something. Something sparkling.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was something he thought, saw on his inner self that he hadn't thought about before.
Mm-hmm.
And there it was reflected for a moment.
Yeah. Did you ever have something like this happen to you? Maybe not looking down a well, but you're out at night and all of a sudden you think you see something and it really couldn't be. I remember when I was a little kid, I saw Santa Claus and his reindeer go across the sky. I was tiny. It's one of my earliest memories. And I was so excited. And I could not understand why my mother was trying to disabuse me of the notion that I had indeed seen Santa Claus. I mean, Santa Claus existed, of course, and I saw him, and wasn't this a wonderful thing? No, she wanted to caution me, I probably hadn't really seen him. And not until years later, when I was finally disabused of the notion, sad day it was, that there is no Santa Claus, did I realize why she, aha, that's why my mother wouldn't accept that. It's a Did you? Are you a Republican? That you didn't see it. So there's something childlike about it. But have you had something like this happen when you're an adult? When you think you see something that's really pretty improbable to see, and yet, there it was. Daydream kind of a thing. Maybe you're sort of half awake and half asleep. Maybe even walking along, but you're daydreaming, and then all of a sudden, you perceive something. Of course, we do it with stars, don't we? We see figures in the stars. We don't know what they are. Wonderful. Pardon me?
Figures in the clouds,
yes indeed, the way Hamlet saw them, Polonius. Yeah. Pardon me?
Or peanuts.
Or Peanuts. Peanuts sees things in the clouds too, right? It's a very childlike poem, isn't it? It's not a kid, you don't think. It's not like a kid. It's an adult, but it's like a child. It's a fun...
Well, is it like looking through a dirty window with binoculars? You don't see the dirt in the window, but yet you can see everything out there. It's only
that's a good
you
idea.
Take
yeah.
the binoculars away and look at the window and change your focus that you're able to see that.
Yeah.
You really have to expand your thought in order to take in that view.
Yes, very good, very good. Or I've noticed another thing sitting up on Chalet 11 porch, looking across the valley when it's just sprinkling a little bit. You look across and it looks as though it's pouring down rain because you're seeing drops so clearly at a number of different levels of your perception. And it looks as if it's raining very hard, but it's not really. So, yeah. Yeah, binoculars are a good example. I want to read one here called After Apple Picking. My long two-pointed ladder is sticking through a tree toward heaven still, and there's a barrel that I didn't fill beside it, and there may be two or three apples I didn't pick upon some bough. But I'm done with apple picking now. Essence of winter sleep is on the night, the scent of apples. I am drowsing off. I cannot rub the strangeness from my sight I got from looking through a pane of glass I skimmed this morning from the drinking trough and held against the world of hoary grass. It melted, and I let it fall and break. But I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell, and I could tell what form of dreaming was about to take. And I could tell what form my dreaming was about to take. Magnified apples appear and disappear, stem end and blossom end, and every fleck of russet showing clear. My instep arch not only keeps the ache, it keeps the pressure of a ladder round. I feel the ladder sway as the boughs bend. And I keep hearing from the cellar bin the rumbling sound of load on load of apples coming in. For I have had too much of apple picking. I am overtired of the great harvest I myself desired. There were 10,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, lift down, and not let fall. For all that struck the earth, no matter if not bruised or spiked with stubble, went surely to the cider apple heap, as of no worth. One can see what will trouble this sleep of mine, whatever sleep it is. Were he not gone, the woodchuck could say whether it's like his long sleep, as I describe it coming on, or just some human sleep. Did you ever pick apples for a long time? Or any kind of fruit? It's an experience that stays with you after you've finished doing it. Especially if you've done it till you're sick to death of doing it, which is the way you usually do it. Go out for a day of blueberry picking, and boy, you don't want to see another blueberry for a long time. But apple picking is even tougher, because if you're up in a tree, your arms get tired, your hands get... Yes, indeed. You cannot bruise them, because they won't last then. So what about this poem? Ingrid?
Well, your way, you gotta do it.
You can't say no. You can't say no, I'll do that tomorrow. I'll take my picking chore tomorrow. You can't do that if it's the long sleep.
You can pick last on top of the
indeed. Tomorrow. Indeed. Indeed. And that gives it a kind of a shimmering, glowing, ambiguous quality, this whole experience. Isn't it? He's the man is.
I don't understand that part about he looks. I got that it happened to him, and yet he talks about that as though he was thinking of it again as he falls asleep and sees something.
Yeah, I think we're back in the well in a way, aren't we? We're looking at something we're not sure what we saw, right? Let's I am drowsing off. I cannot rub the strangeness from my sight I got from looking through a pane of glass I skimmed this morning from the drinking trough and held against the world of hoary grass. It melted, and I let it fall and break. But I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell, and I could tell what form my dreaming was about to take. And then he goes on to the shimmering aspect of the apples. So that experience early on in the morning of looking through the glass, which he perceived the ice as being, is rather like his memory of what transpired in the ambiguous quality of dreaming, waking, dreaming, waking, and having this image of all these apples. It's like the experience that he had this morning looking through the glass at the grass and then having it drop and then it's gone. That image is gone, just like the image of the quartz, if quartz it was, or truth. I think you decided it was truth, didn't you? That he saw down at the bottom of the well? No, you didn't make a commitment on that. No. Right, I haven't either. So this is even more ambiguous, isn't it? What exactly happened to the man? What happened to the experience of picking those apples all day long? Any other insights into it? Any other thoughts about it? Well, he thought of death as a good New Englander would, that it's there. It's not, he's not a person who was constantly writing about death, constantly thinking about death. His references to death are largely metaphorical like this, or like the thrush that we dealt with last time. You remember the thrush? Probably if it's in Holden Village, by the way, that thrush was a Swainson's thrush, probably, right? There's no extra charge for these little ornithological observations, as I told you. They go with your tuition for this class. Sir?
Also, something of the other of the two rows there, because he left some apples up there, and but he bypassed them, but he regrets bypassing them.
He's not going to worry about them. In other words, he
knows what apple pickling is like when he talks about his arches taken all on those.
Isn't that a great image? I love that image. I love that image.
In the Cashmere, when I was a kid one time, and you have one, you just have a three-legged ladder, but it is a little unsteady.
Yes, you're very aware of the risk of it. I've done a little of it, too. Yeah, here's what he says. My instep arch not only keeps the ache, it keeps the pressure of a ladder round. I feel the ladder sway as the boughs bend. It's a wonderful... You can actually feel that, can't you? Not only is it sore, but I can actually... I've still got those under there. I can still feel them there. Right? You, all day long, you shift your feet so that it isn't quite so painful, but you still have that feeling of them being there, right? Fine. I want to finish up with one other, which is a fairly short one. One for you to think about. We've only got a few minutes, but I just want you to have this one to think about as you fall asleep tonight. This is called Into My Own. One of my wishes is that those dark trees, so old and firm they scarcely show the breeze, were not, as 'twere, the merest mask of gloom, but stretched away unto the edge of doom. I should not be withheld, but that some day into their vastness I should steal away. Fearless of ever finding open land or highway where the slow wheel pours the sand, I do not see why I should e'er turn back, or those should not set forth upon my track to overtake me, who should miss me here and long to know if I still held them dear. They would not find me changed from him they knew, only more sure of all I thought was true. Shall I give it to you one more time?
Yeah.
This is chock full. Into My Own. One of my wishes is that those dark trees, so old and firm they scarcely show the breeze, were not as 'twere the merest mask of gloom, but stretched away beyond, stretched away unto the edge of doom. I should not be withheld, but that some day into their vastness I should steal away, fearless of ever finding open land or highway where the slow wheel pours the sand. I do not see why I should e'er turn back, or those should not set forth upon my track to overtake me, who should miss me here and long to know if I still held them dear. They would not find me changed from him they knew, only more sure of all I thought was true. If I'd wanted you to know, I'd have told you in the poem. But it certainly could be the sands of time. What other kinds of sands could it be? Okay, but I wonder if you would, maybe I'd finish this and I'd ask you, can you be with us tomorrow? Maybe not. Anyway, yeah, okay. And maybe the rest of us think about this. Would you really think that you could say to people who knew you when you were sweet 16, they would not find me changed from him they knew, or her they knew in your case, only more sure of all I thought was true then? Would you be able to say that? Do you think, would I be able to say that? Huh? Let's take another look at this tomorrow. And I also want you to think a little more about that slow wheel pouring the sand. And I don't want us to be too metaphorical, too... This could be something pretty straightforward, okay? Huh? Think about it a little more. And I'll read it again tomorrow and we'll see what we think that sand is. Think about it, okay? Okay?
The standing seemed to be the tree stretching into an infinity point, whether it's through the forest,
yeah,
or looking.
Yeah, okay. It's not an easy poem. That's why it's fun. See you tomorrow, whoever can be here. Thanks a lot.